Chapter 11, The Pregnant Years. Be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail. For now shalt thou go forth out of the city, and thou shalt dwell in the field, and thou shalt go even to Babylon. There shalt thou be delivered. There the Lord shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. Micah 1866. The spring and summer of 1866 were far from uneventful. The Pattersons moved to a room in Mr. Russell's house in Lynn toward the end of March. Mrs. Patterson's all-absorbing interest was scientific healing, and the Russells became very hostile toward her and her views. Dr. Patterson was disinterested as usual, and early in June, he again deserted his wife, this time eloping with the wife of a wealthy patient. Lacking the $1.50 with which to pay the weekly room rent, Mary was evicted by the bigoted Russells and sought refuge with elderly Quaker friends in Lynn, Thomas and Hannah Phillips. Their youngest son, 15-year-old Dor, was suffering from a painfully infected finger. Mrs. Patterson asked him if he would like her to treat it for him, and he accepted eagerly. She asked his cooperation in not looking at it or allowing others to do so, and also in dismissing it from his thought, insofar as that was possible. When he went to the nearby home of his married sister, Susan Oliver, to spend the night, she wanted to inspect it, and he refused, explaining Mrs. Patterson's instructions. Next morning, they were both amazed to discover that there was not a vestige of evidence of the painful felon that had kept him out of school and in agony for several days. But Mrs. Oliver was skeptical. Though she was fond of Mrs. Patterson, she doubted her theories. Her gentle father had no such doubts. He recognized Mary's spirituality and sensed her mission. In his mild way, he rebuked his daughter's unbelief by saying, "Mary is a wonderful woman, Susie. You will find it out someday. I may not live to see it, but you will." At this time, Mary had no trace of her husband, save his last letter, in which he had written, quote, "I hope sometime to be worthy of so good a wife," end quote. Then, toward the end of July, a contrite Daniel appeared at the door, and once more Mary endeavored to pick up the shreds of an impossible marriage. They moved into a nearby boarding house, owned by Mrs. Clark. But before the end of August, Daniel had disappeared once again, this time to avoid arrest for his previous indiscretions. And once again, Mary had to turn to friends for a sheltering roof. She was always welcomed by the Phillipses and the Olivers, and also by Mrs. Phillips' sister and her husband, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Winslow. The Winslows were people of considerable means and had a beautiful house on Ocean Street. They were devout Christians, and their happiness was only marred by Mrs. Winslow's invalidism. She had not walked naturally for many years. Mrs. Patterson spent a good deal of time in one or another of the homes of these dear friends, and spoke much of spiritual healing. One summer day in 1866, Mrs. Patterson was on the beach in Lynn when she saw a sad sight that needed healing. Mrs. James Norton of Lynn had taken her 7-year-old son, George, to Lynn Beach and left him there while she hitched the horse and went for water. The child had club feet and had never walked. When the mother returned, she was stunned to see her boy walking hand in hand with a strange woman. Mrs. Norton and the stranger, Mrs. Patterson, looked into each other's eyes. Then both wept and joined in thanks to God. The child was completely and permanently healed and lived a happy, useful life. Mary's consuming interest was spiritual healing, and she was beginning to prove the truth of her hypotheses in practice, but she had no place to lay her head. Without home, without funds, she was a constant visitor in the homes of friends, and even the kindest were not much interested in her ideas. The dear Winslows had told her they thought it best if she would not discuss her revolutionary ideas. Without husband or family, she was alone in the world, as she depicted so graphically on the 3rd of September in these words, "I'm sitting alone. I'm sitting alone where the shadows fall, in somber groups at the vesper call, where tear dews of night seek the loving rose, her bosom to fill with mortal woes. I'm waiting alone for the bridal hour of nymph and naiad from woodland bower, till vestal pearls that on leaflets lay, ravished with beauty, the eye of day. I'm watching alone o'er the starlit glow, o'er the silvery moon and ocean flow, and sketching in light the heaven of my youth, its starry hopes and its waves of truth. I'm dreaming alone of its changeful sky. What rainbows of rapture floated by, of a mother's love that no words could speak when parting the ringlets to kiss my cheek. I'm thinking alone of a fair young bride, the light of a home of love and pride, how the glance of her husband's watchful eye turned to his star of idolatry. I'm picturing alone a glad young face, upturned to his mother's in playful grace, and the unsealed fountains of grief and joy that gushed at the birth of that beautiful boy. I'm weeping alone that the vision is fled, the leaves all faded, the fruitage shed, and wishing this earth more gifts from above, our reason made right, and hearts all love." Late in the summer, she found a peaceful refuge with friends in Swampscott, Mrs. Mary Ellis and her son Fred, the village schoolmaster. Here she began writing in earnest on the theme nearest her heart. She would write all day in her chamber, and in the evenings read the pages to the Ellises for their comments and criticisms. This was perhaps the only home where her spiritual ideas met no resistance. This brief interlude is well described in a letter Mrs. Eddy received from Fred Ellis in 1901. "How many times I have thought of writing a line to try whether you still remember your old friends, Mrs. Ellis and her son, with any such interest as has ever gathered about my recollection of you and of our acquaintance to me so delightful in those far away days at Swampscott. I have kept the even tenor of my way, teaching school with a persistence that would be monotony but for the stimulus and cheer that come through association with children. I have my own 4 and my 1,000 and more in school to keep me feeling young. And you, what can I say? Words fail when I think of the marvelous work thou hast wrought. It may be presumption in me to address you. I do so not in the light of the magnificence of your achievement, but out of my cherished remembrance of those precious evenings in the little sitting room at Swampscott, when the words of Jesus of truth were so illumined by your inspired interpretation. All that may have passed from your memory, but not from mine. Accept my heartfelt wishes for your further success and for your peace of mind under the irritating assaults of malicious enemies. Mrs. Eddy did not forget, and in her reply to Mr. Ellis, she wrote, quote, "Do you forget your Christmas present to me? That basket of kindling all split by your hand and left at my door? I do not." End quote. Though Daniel had been a very poor provider, Mary had managed to get by with income from her writing, but all of her time was now given to God's work, and there was no remuneration. In her words, quote, "Before entering upon my great life work, my income from literary sources was ample, until declining dictation as to what I should write, I became poor for Christ's sake." End quote. One day when Mary was with the Phillipses, Daniel came to the door, expecting to be forgiven once more. The mild Mr. Phillips was infuriated at the audacity of such a faithless husband, and raised his cane to strike him, whereupon Mary interceded. But she did not receive her husband again. She had made her last attempt to salvage their marriage. So Daniel Patterson wandered out of her life. He went first to the Tiltons to confess his sins and his sorrow. He agreed not to leave Mary destitute, and promised to provide her with $200 a year, which he did for a short time, in small, irregular amounts. Abigail wrote Mary, making a very generous offer to build her a new home of her own, and to settle an income upon her. But in return, she required that Mary give up her theory of divine healing. She may as well have requested that she stop breathing. Mary was embarking upon a new life, although it would be 2 more years before she resumed the name Glover, and 7 more before she obtained a divorce from Dr. Patterson. In the fall, she returned to the pleasant boarding house of Mrs. Clark on Summer Street, which was but a short distance from her dear Quaker friends. The reminiscences of Mrs. Clark's son, George, afford a picture of Mrs. Patterson in the fall of 1866. She was a beautiful woman, with the complexion of a young girl, her skin being fair, the color often glowing in her cheeks as she talked. Her eyes were deep blue, becoming brilliant and large under emotional interest, and her hair falling in a shower of brown curls about her face. She usually wore black, but occasionally violet or pale rose. And I remember well a dove-colored gown, trimmed with black velvet, that she wore in the summer. I remember the colors because she suggested a flower-like appearance. She had a refreshing simplicity about her, which made one think of lilies. Usually, she was reserved, though her expression was never forbidding. But when she talked, and she talked very well and convincingly, she would often make a sweeping outward gesture with her right hand, as though giving her thought from her very heart. My mother was much interested in spiritualism and used to entertain the spiritualist. My mother and Mrs. Patterson would occasionally get into a lively argument, and both expressed themselves most positively on opposite sides of the question. They never fell out about it, for they were both too well used to such divergence of view among their friends. They respected each other. I may say they had too much affection to quarrel. But their arguments were highly entertaining to me, and I often wondered how persons holding such opposite views could shake hands so amiably over their differences. Mrs. Patterson sat at the head of Mrs. Clark's table of 14 and was always listened to with interest when she cared to talk. According to George, she was admired and liked by all, though her statements sometimes caused protracted arguments. On her left sat a young man from Stoughton named Hiram S. Crafts. He was an expert heel finisher and had come to Lynn to work in a shoe factory. He was also a spiritualist. But unlike Mrs. Clark, he was persuaded by Mrs. Patterson's arguments against spiritualism, and became very interested in her theory of scientific healing. In Mrs. Clark's parlor in the evenings, some played whist, but there was always a group gathered round Mrs. Patterson, questioning and listening. She was gaining the scientific certainty that all causation is infinite mind, and had proved in numerous cases of healing the truth of her conclusions. Every evening, her most interested questioner and listener was Hiram Crafts. With Mrs. Patterson's encouragement, he soon felt that he too could heal according to her theory. So late in the fall, he and his wife returned to their home in Stoughton, where he planned to practice metaphysical healing. Shortly after their departure, Mrs. Patterson received an urgent letter from Mrs. Crafts requesting her to come to them and help her husband to commence practice. What a problem! How to teach frail mortals from her spiritual height? In her words, "I discovered in 1866 the momentous facts relating to mind and its superiority over matter. Yet there remained the difficulty of adjusting in the scale of science a metaphysical practice and settling the question, what shall be the outward sign of such a practice? If a divine principle alone heals, what is the human modus for demonstrating this? In short, how can sinful mortals prove that a divine principle heals the sick, as well as governs the universe, time, space, immortality, man? When contemplating the majesty and magnitude of this query, it looked as if centuries of spiritual growth were requisite to enable me to elucidate or to demonstrate what I had discovered, but an unlooked-for imperative call for help impelled me to begin this stupendous work at once and teach the first student in Christian Science. Start where you stand is the beginning of the road to accomplishment, and circumstances caused Mary to make that beginning. The trials she was to encounter in teaching divine science to mortal consciousness were beyond comprehension. Bitter, bitter experiences lay in the path of the chosen of God, who would give her life for others. As 1866 drew to a close, the greatest teacher in the history of the world embarked upon her teaching mission, a mission which caused her to write, quote, "If the master had not taken a student and taught the unseen verities of God, he would not have been crucified," end quote. The move to Stoughton. The first of the new year found Mrs. Patterson in East Stoughton, 16 miles due south of Boston, living with Hiram and Mary Crafts. She gave him his tuition, and as Mr. Crafts wrote later, quote, "She furnished our parlor and gave us the use of her furniture free of cost while she remained with us," end quote. Hiram's success in healing was phenomenal, due largely to the unremitting help from his teacher. In 1901, he wrote, quote, "She never taught me in my mental practice to hurt others, but only to heal the sick and reform the sinner. She taught me from the scriptures and from manuscripts that she wrote as she taught me," end quote. She also healed the more difficult cases and those who sought help from the teacher rather than from the young doctor. James Ingman and Allison C. Wentworth were two residents of East Stoughton who later wrote testimonials of their healings by Mrs. Glover. The larger town of Taunton, Massachusetts, 16 miles distant and 32 miles south of Boston, offered greater promise for the young man. So in April of 1867, the Crafts and their mentor moved there to new and larger quarters. Mrs. Patterson wrote to her sister Martha, quote, "The doct here is just beginning at great expense in a new place, but all that come to him sick he cures," end quote. Having adopted the proper title, according to the gracious simplicity of those days, Mr. Crafts inserted the following advertisement in a Taunton newspaper. "To the sick, Dr. H. S. Crafts would say unhesitatingly, I can cure you, and I have never failed to cure consumption, catarrh, scrofula, dyspepsia, and rheumatism, with many other forms of disease and weakness, in which I am especially successful. If you give me a fair trial and are not helped, I will refund your money." A few weeks later, on May 13th, his advertisement included a testimony from Mrs. Abigail Raymond of Taunton, which read as follows. "In giving to the public a statement of my peculiar case, I am actuated by a motive to point out the way to others of relief from their sufferings. About 12 years since, I had an internal abscess that not only threatened to destroy my life at that time, but which has ever since continued to affect me in some form or another internally, making life well nigh a burden to bear. I have consulted many physicians, all of whom have failed to relieve me of this suffering, and in this condition, while growing worse year by year, about 3 weeks ago I applied to Dr. H.S. Crafts, who, to my own and the utter astonishment of my friends, has in this incredibly short time, without medicines or painful applications, cured me of this chronic malady. In conclusion, I can only quote the words of a patient who was healed by his method of cure. Quote, "I am convinced he is a skillful physician whose cures are not the result of accident." End quote. I reside in Taunton at Weir Street Railroad Crossing. Abigail Raymond. The cures of the skillful physician most certainly were not the result of accident. With the constant help of his teacher, he was healing all manner of disease, and most particularly cases that the regular schools had failed to cure. Hiram Crafts was an apt pupil, but his spirituality and his faith in God did not begin to approximate that of Mrs. Patterson, so he did not always practice wholly according to her method and her instructions. On February 23, 1902, he wrote to Calvin Fry, "Mrs. Eddy never instructed me to rub the head or body or manipulate in any form. But when I was a spiritualist, I used to use water and rub the head, limbs, and body. So sometimes, when I was studying with her, I would try it, but I did not say anything to her about it." He did not need to say anything to her about it. If it was in his thought, he could not keep it from her. But Dr. Quimby had used the material application of rubbing and water, and at this point, Mrs. Patterson saw no harm in it. So she allowed her first pupil this material crutch upon which to lean, even including it for some of her next students, before she learned that it was a vehicle that could be used for evil. Late in July, Mary received word from her sister Martha that Ellen, Martha's daughter, was lying at the point of death. She was suffering from what her physicians called enteritis of the severest form, after typhoid fever, and had been given up by three physicians. Mary went at once to her old home in Sanborton Bridge, where Ellen lay. The house her father had built belonged now to George Sullivan, who had inherited all of his father's property at the death of Mark Baker in 1865. George's wife said that when Mary arrived, such a change came over the household. "We all felt the angel of the Lord appeared, and glory shone round." Mary's stepmother, Mrs. Elizabeth P. Baker, wrote of Mary's visit to Ellen. In a few moments, after Mrs. Glover entered the room and stood by her bedside, she recognized her aunt and said, "I am glad to see you, Auntie." In about 10 minutes more, Mrs. Glover told her to rise from her bed and walk. She rose and walked 7 times across her room, then sat down in a chair. For 2 weeks before this, we had not entered her room without stepping lightly. Her bowels were so tender, she felt the jar, and it increased her sufferings. She could only be moved on a sheet from bed to bed. When she walked across the room at Mrs. Glover's bidding, she told her to stamp her foot strongly upon the floor, and she did so without suffering from it. The next day, she was dressed and went down to the table, and the fourth day went a journey of about 100 miles in the cars. There was some rejoicing at Ellen's recovery, but it was muted, for Mary's family was not unlike Jesus. Quote, "Neither did his brethren believe in him," end quote. Her brother George was a bitter old man. His marriage had not been a happy one. He was now blind, and he would not allow Mary to help him. Abigail, who had done so much to help Mary in the past, resented her independence and rejected her now, and they were all embarrassed by her unorthodox ideas. So 4 days after healing Ellen, Mary returned to Taunton. She had persuaded her niece to accompany her and to continue treatment with Dr. Crafts. Perhaps she felt that Ellen's interest would convert her family. But alas, Ellen Pillsbury was from the town's first family and was accustomed to refinement and gracious behavior. Mary Craft's background was common and vulgar. Her contact with greatness for the past several months, which could have elevated her life to new heights, instead had caused a smoldering resentment. As soon as Mrs. Patterson had left for Sanborton Bridge, Mrs. Craft's smoldering emotions had burst into flames, and she had made life miserable for her husband. When aunt and niece arrived, they came into a very hostile household. Ellen reacted with hostility toward her aunt. She packed her bags and returned home, convinced that her family was right about her aunt's behavior and companions, making the break between Mary and her family permanent. Not only was the rift with her family wider and deeper, but her wonderful beginning with her first student was in ruins. Hiram's career was at an end. His wife was returning to East Stoughton. Only a few months before, Mrs. Patterson's marriage had ended in disaster, and the wound was not yet healed. The members of her family, once so close and loving, were now all distant and hostile. Almost a year's work of teaching spiritual healing lay in ashes. In the summer of 1867, she was alone, as her poem records. Alone. No answering tone, no gentle smile, life's joys to share or griefs beguile, their sunshine or its shadows fling, those hours have fled with life's glad spring, and left this heart a seashell's moan, repeating ever all alone. O weary heart, O tired sigh, alone to live, alone to die. Love's golden chain and fervent vow are broken and forever now. Oh, can he bask in fortune's ray, who took from out my skies their day, or love to learn and willing own, He's made a heart forever lone. O weary heart, O tired sigh, alone to live, alone to die. When cruel men kept all my gain, oft stored in tears, through toil and pain, I've sought the home my childhood gave, a moment's shelter from the wave. Then those when sick, whose pain I bore, a sister drove me from the door. O weary heart, O tired sigh, so wronged to live, alone I'd die. Yet not alone, for oft I see bright forms that look in love on me. To thee, thou lost ones, and my own, I call, oh, leave me not alone. When answering tones this music pour, thy God is with thee evermore. Oh, better bliss that knows no sigh, oh, love divine, so full, so nigh. And o'er the harp strings of the soul, sweet sounds this trembling echo roll. Thy love can live in truth, and be a joy and immortality, to bless mankind with word and deed, thy life a great and noble creed. O glorious hope, my faith renew. O mortal joys, adieu, adieu. August 13th, 1867. The months in Amesbury. Mary Patterson had looked back upon her unhappy marriage for the last time. She may have hoped that her refusal to accept Daniel's behavior would have caused a true reform on his part, but no such reformation had occurred. In bidding adieu to mortal joys, she dropped the name Patterson and resumed her former name of Glover. For a temporary refuge, Mary returned to her friends, the Winslows and Lynn. She longed for peace and quiet in which to write and to pursue the work God had given her to do. The Winslows suggested the quiet little town of Amesbury, about 40 miles to the north, where they had a friend Mary could contact. Thus, in the fall of 1867, Mary Glover knocked at the door of Mrs. Mary Esther Carter in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Mrs. Carter, the Winslows' friend, could not accommodate Mrs. Glover, but she kindly recommended the nearby home of Captain and Mrs. Nathaniel Webster. Captain Webster was a retired sea captain, who was presently superintendent of a cotton mill in Manchester, only visiting his home in Amesbury every other Sunday. But Mrs. Webster was seldom alone in their 15-room house. Mother Webster, as everyone called her, was devoted to spiritualism and was known as a drawing medium and a healing medium in the terminology of that day. She was also sympathetic, charitable, and hospitable, and constantly had a house full of boarders, including invalids, unfortunates, and charity patients. When Mrs. Glover introduced herself and explained her situation, Mother Webster said, "Glory to God, come right in." Mrs. Glover did not believe in spiritualism, but she had found that those who did were often easier to interest in her science than were those of orthodox faith. Mother Webster was much impressed with Mrs. Glover's spirituality and with the healings she performed. She gave her a lovely room and accorded her special household privileges. For many months, Mary was able to devote herself to writing. her spiritual interpretation of the Bible, begun at the Ellis's in Swampscott, grew to great proportions. These copious writings were footsteps for Science and Health, which was still in embryo, but her babe that would come forth after 9 years had its beginning in this early manuscript on Genesis, wherein she wrote, quote, "The time for thinkers has come," end quote. Occultism and the supernatural had no part in Mrs. Glover's science. Of these early compositions, the author says, "Before writing this work, Science and Health, she made copious notes of scriptural exposition, which have never been published." This was during the years 1867 and 1868. These efforts show her comparative ignorance of the stupendous life problem up to that time, and the degrees by which she came at length to its solution. But she values them as a parent may treasure the memorials of a child's growth, and she would not have them changed. It would appear that Mrs. Glover went to Swampscott to spend the Christmas holidays with her friends, the Ellis's, for the following appeared in the Lynn Reporter early in January. Invocation for 1868. Father of every age, of every rolling sphere, help us to write a deathless page of truth this dawning year. Mary Baker Glover, Swampscott, Massachusetts, January 1st. Back in Amesbury, Mrs. Glover was writing a deathless page of truth, and these are the copious notes that show the steps of her progress up to the solution of the great life problem, and which she would not have changed. But one of her writings of that period she has changed. On the 15th of February, her original version of Christ My Refuge appeared in the Lynn Reporter in 8 stanzas. Over the voice harp of my soul, there sweeps a hand. Beyond this mortal weak control, from some soft band of ministries, a white-winged throng of thoughts illumined by God and breathed in raptured song with love perfumed. And in this unveiled presence grew a ladder bright, rising to bear me upward to a world of light, not from this earthly home afar, but nearer thee, Father, to shine a loving star or crystal sea. Over the waves of doubt and fear, time's Galilee, aid me to walk, Christ ever near, to strengthen me, and fix my sight on God, the rock, upon my shore, gainst which the winds and waves may shock, oh, nevermore. I am no reed to shake at scorn or hate of man. I am no medium but truths to warn the creedish clan. Gainst their oppression and their wrong, to crucify the Christ whose deeds they must prolong, to hold him nigh. Mrs. Glover and Mrs. Webster became close friends, although the latter comprehended little of the truth Mary was imparting to her. But she did witness many healings, as did the others in her house, until Mrs. Glover was the talk of the small town. One such healing was that of Mrs. Mary M. Gale of Manchester, who was a friend of the Websters. Mrs. Gale was critically ill with pneumonia on May 30th when she sent Mrs. Glover a telegram asking her to come to her. Mary went immediately to Manchester and healed Mrs. Gale. While there, she saw a copy of a dictionary of the Bible by William Smith, which had recently been published and which interested her very much. Mary was not satisfied with healing all who sought her aid. She longed to impart to others the principle of this healing. She had proven that this could be done, and that others could practice mental healing successfully in the few months she had instructed and assisted Hiram Crafts. She needed another student to work with. So as spring turned to summer, she wrote an advertisement. Any person desiring to learn how to heal the sick can receive of the undersigned instruction that will enable them to commence healing on a principle of science with a success far beyond any of the present modes. No medicine, electricity, physiology, or hygiene required for unparalleled success in the most difficult cases. No pay is required unless this skill is obtained. Address Mrs. Mary B. Glover, Amesbury, Massachusetts, Box 61, TF, June 20th. Because she had found some receptivity among spiritualists, she placed her advertisement in their publication, Banner of Light. But the time for Mary to move on had arrived, with or without a place to go, or a student to teach. Mrs. Webster's son had brought his three children from New York to spend each summer school vacation with their grandparents in Amesbury, ever since his wife had died 3 or 4 years earlier. He thought the influence of Mother Webster's friends and patients undesirable for his children, so he preceded their visit each year and evicted all her tenants. He arrived toward the end of June in 1868, and Mrs. Glover, with all the rest, was put out into the street. Three of them, Mrs. Glover, a Mrs. Richardson, and an 18-year-old lad named Richard Kennedy, stood together discussing where to go. Mrs. Richardson knew a kindly woman who lived nearby and who, she was sure, would give them a night's lodging. Therefore, the trio went to the home of Miss Sarah Bagley on Main Street. Miss Bagley was a well-educated, cultured New England spinster, and the refinement of her home was refreshing to Mrs. Glover. The others moved on, but Mary remained with Miss Bagley for several weeks. While there, she received grateful letters from Mrs. Gale in Manchester, together with a gift of Smith's Dictionary of the Bible. In the latest edition of Science and Health, there is a reference from this volume. Mrs. Bagley was interested in Mrs. Glover's science, but the young man she had met at the Websters, Richard Kennedy, was even more interested. He would come by in the evenings after his day's work that he might learn from Mrs. Glover and enter into the metaphysical discussions. Mrs. Glover did not yet know that he was destined to become her second student, and neither he nor she had any inkling of the temptations that would beset his path and the part he would play in the drama of Mrs. Eddy's earth experience. Sarah Bagley was related to the poet John Greenleaf Whittier, and they were friends. He had been critically ill the previous winter and was suffering again from incipient pulmonary consumption when Miss Bagley took Mrs. Glover to visit him. They found him huddled over the fire, feverish and coughing, though it was a warm summer day. Mrs. Glover remarked that the atmosphere seemed better outside than in, and he replied that if Jesus Christ lived in Amesbury, he would have to have brass-lined lungs to survive. But he responded to Mrs. Glover's ideas as they conversed, for her spirituality touched upon a chord in the poet's thought. Before long, the sunshine of his former character beamed through the cloud, and when they rose to go, he took both of Mary's hands in his own and said, "I thank thee, Mary, for thy call. It has done me much good. Come again." And indeed it had. He was completely healed. He was out and around the next day, which the neighbors noted, for the change was so sudden and remarkable. When the estate of Squire Bagley, Sarah's father, had been settled, it was learned that his fortunes had faded, and there was little more than the house for his daughter's inheritance. In order to meet expenses, Sarah had taught school for a time, had opened a shop in her home, and was presently doing sewing. But her meager funds would not permit a guest in the house. Mrs. Glover's financial situation was even more difficult than Sarah's. For 2 years, she had been doing Christ's work, healing all manner of disease, and yet she scarcely had a cent with which to pay for the necessities. She had been endeavoring to instruct Mrs. Gale in Manchester, who was most appreciative. On the 8th of August, the latter had written, quote, "I feel, dear Mrs. Glover, that I owe you all I am able to do for you, and then my debt would never be discharged," end quote. She offered lavish financial assistance. But when Mrs. Glover accepted and moved to Manchester, Mrs. Gale was shocked. Mrs. Glover was learning that you cannot trust mortal mind, because it cannot trust itself. But she was in a very difficult, unpleasant situation. She thought of going to her son, George Glover, in the West, but by the 10th of September, she was in East Stoughton. She wrote Sarah Bagley from there, saying, quote, "Oh, I am tired. Tired. When will my rest come?" End quote.